Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs. 21 plus. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.
Hello and welcome back to Chronicles, where today we're going to be talking all about the second part of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights. Now, I do have to start with something of a confession, which is that when I sat down to record part one, I hadn't actually had in mind for it to be an hour 40 minutes, but I just ended up sitting here and just going into it in far more depth than I anticipated. And why not? After all, there is so much to say, obviously, about it, but I will endeavour to keep this one a leaner, tighter beast, and I hope that I can get it all to you in a much more concise manner. But let's just start, shall we, by reflecting on, you know, what did happen in part one, where some of our characters are, which ones are no longer with us, and then we can go into a bit of a recap, and then we'll go into the entirety of part two and the other half of the story that awaits us. So, at the heart of all of this, we have the battle between nature and civilization, between Wuthering Heights, which, you know, even in the name Wuthering, there's an idea of it being battered by the very weather, which is exactly as Mr. Lockwood first finds it. And but also the characters in the actual house as well, once Heathcliff takes mastery over it. These are people who are against civilization. And I don't mean that in a conscious sense, of course, but I mean in their actions, how they conduct themselves. They're kind of anti-refinement characters. Heathcliff is not a refined man in the first half. Hindley is certainly not. And Cathy is young and wild and free. And in fact, those authoritative levelling up voices, those ones that give some sort of like moral instruction, are also very cold, very harsh voices, like that of Joseph, who I didn't really talk about a great deal in the first part. But there is undoubtedly a strong religious element to Wuthering Heights, and that's something I'll certainly come on to by the very end of this. But one thing to say is just that Joseph obviously represents a strain or a type of preacher, evangelist, that Bronte herself really didn't like. And Joseph is a man who speaks very puritanically, he's very austere, but all of it, the rhetoric, is about hell and fire and brimstone and wrath. There's an entire lack of the attitudes of mercy and clemency and understanding and charity. All of these things are kind of absent from Wuthering Heights. And then, of course, this is entirely juxtaposed with Thrushcross Grange and the life of the Lintons, Edgar and Isabella, who live a much more refined and much more, one would probably think, aspirational, comfortable middle-class life in Thrushcross Grange. But Nelly makes the point that it is not simply a case of us choosing nature or civilization, one or the other. It is a realm of trade-offs, and that despite Heathcliff and his shortcomings and his outsider status and his mysterious Byronic past, he has a resilience and a fortitude, and, you know, he's weathered the bitterness of life very, very well. And that has chiseled into him a very, very strong will. And especially when we couple that with the fact that the civilizational side of things with the Lintons took his wild love, Cathy, away from him, then, well, going into part two, we're going to see a very, very dark and a very brutal Heathcliff indeed. One other thing just to say about this recap is that, of course, one of the main themes of Wuthering Heights is trauma, and the trauma that all of these characters carry on, and the sort of great chain of revenge and dominance, and the trauma of what Heathcliff endured in Wuthering Heights growing up, at the hands of Hindley and then later on at the hands of Edgar, creates in it now a position where Heathcliff is finally the one with the absolute power in, you know, this little solitary area of the Yorkshire Moors. It's amongst this desolation, it's remarkable in a way. This is a place with very, very few people. It's very sparsely populated. And you think to yourself, well, with so few people, can they not all just get along? You know, I mean, this isn't the city where it's full of gossips and slanderers. Oh, no. This is brutal. And Heathcliff acts like a black hole. And anyone who is happy just gets dragged into the vortex of his wrath. And as I say, we'll see all of this come with time. So let's begin by talking about what happens in part two of Wuthering Heights. We're going to get an introduction to many of the newer characters, such as Little Cathy, the daughter of other Cathy. So we had Catherine Earnshaw, and she married Edgar Linton, and they had a daughter. So we have now Cathy Linton. And also as well, Edgar's sister Isabella had a child with Heathcliff after he basically tricked her and charmed her into marrying him and then used her as a tool of revenge against Edgar. And Isabella ran away and she's gone for 12 years. And in that time, at the beginning of that, she gave birth to her and Heathcliff's son called Linton Heathcliff. And obviously all these names do cross over somewhat, but it's a great way of showing how all of the allegiances and identities getting intertwined with one another. And all of a sudden we have a man called Linton being a tool of the man called Heathcliff. And we have young Cathy Linton, who Heathcliff is going to try to force into marriage with his son so that she can become Cathy Heathcliff. And so there's this idea of revenge and taking that name Linton away from her and forcing this young Cathy, who's inherited all of this trouble and all of this strife, forcing her to take that name. And so names are very, very important in it because they say something about the moral content of the characters themselves. So let's begin and talk all about part two of Wuthering Heights. The 12 years, continued Mrs. Jean, following that dismal period were the happiest of my life. My greatest troubles in their passage rose from our little lady's trifling illness, which she had to experience in common with all children, rich and poor. For the rest, after the first 6 months, she grew like a larch, and could walk and talk too, in her own way, before the heath blossomed a second time over Mrs. Linton's dust. She was the most winning thing that ever brought sunshine into a desolate house. A real beauty in face, with the Earnshaw's handsome dark eyes, but the Linton's fair skin and small features, and yellow curling hair. Her spirit was high, though not rough, and qualified by a heart sensitive and lively to excess in its affections. That capacity for intense attachments reminded me of her mother. Still, she did not resemble her, for she could be soft and mild as a dove, and she had a gentle voice and pensive expression. Her anger was never furious, her love never fierce. It was deep and tender. However, it must be acknowledged she had faults to foil her gifts. A propensity to be saucy was one, and the perverse will that indulged children invariably acquire, whether they be good-tempered or cross. If a servant chanced to vex her, it was always, "I shall tell Papa." And if he reproved her, even by a look, you would have thought it was a heartbreaking business. I don't believe he ever did speak a harsh word to her. He took her education entirely on himself and made it an amusement. Fortunately, curiosity and a quick intellect made her an apt scholar. She learned rapidly and eagerly, and she did honour to his teachings. Till she reached the age of 13, she had not once been beyond the range of the park by herself. Mr. Linton would take her with him a mile or so outside on rare occasions, but he trusted her to no one else. Nellie Dean, ever the faithful housekeeper, watches over her, ensuring the ghosts of the past remain buried. But curiosity stirs in young Cathy. She overhears a servant talk of the fairy cave and sets her ambitions on seeing the Penistone Crag. A window of opportunity soon presents itself when Edgar receives a letter from his dying sister, Isabella. She beseeches her estranged brother to come and visit her and to take the child she had had with Heathcliff into his care. Upon reading her words, Edgar sets off without hesitation. And during his 3 weeks of absence, young Cathy, evading Nellie's vigilance, sneaks out to see the crag. Her route takes her past Wuthering Heights, and she encounters Hareton Earnshaw, now a strapping youth of 18, his broad shoulders bent from labour, his speech rough and unpolished, his mind starved of learning by Heathcliff's deliberate neglect. But such details are lost on the innocent hearts of children, and Cathy, joyfully exploring the land for the first time, goes with him to play at Penistone Crag. Nellie pants with fear for the young girl, who she naturally believes to be lost and alone on a moor of unrelenting vastness and danger. To the servant's great relief, she finds the two of them at Wuthering Heights. Nellie then explains to young Cathy that Hareton is not the master of Wuthering Heights, but that he is, in fact, her cousin. Cathy becomes aloof and repelled at the thought of having such unrefined kin. When Nellie finally manages to get the unruly girl to leave with her, she also makes a promise not to tell her father about her escape from Thrushcross Grange and the events that followed, for fear of her father furiously terminating Nellie's employment. Little Cathy agrees, but the first contact has been made, and now Heathcliff will know of the existence of his son, Linton, and his arrival at the home of his enemies. When Edgar returns with the young boy, he is revealed to be a very unimpressive specimen, whiny, sickly, weak. Heathcliff sends Joseph over to collect him, but Edgar explains that he will bring the boy tomorrow morning, giving him up without a fight. Isabella had never told Linton about his father or his deplorable nature, and Nellie tries to console the young lad as she escorts him to Wuthering Heights, all the time knowing what a desperate existence she moves him towards. "Hello, Nellie," said Mr. Heathcliff when he saw me. "I feared I should have to come down and fetch my property myself. You brought it, have you? Let us see what we can make of it." "Do you know me?" asked Heathcliff, having satisfied himself that the limbs were all equally frail and feeble.
"No,"
said Linton, with a gaze of vacant fear. "You've heard of me, I dare say."
"No,"
he replied again. "No. What a shame of your mother never to waken your filial regard for me. You are my son, then, I'll tell you, and your mother was a wicked slut to leave you in ignorance of the sort of father you possessed. Now, don't wince and colour up, though it is something to see that you have not white blood. Be a good lad, and I'll do for you. Nellie, if you be tired, you may sit down. If not, get home again. I guess you'll report what you hear and see to the cipher at the Grange, and this thing won't be settled while you linger about it." "Well," replied I hope you'll be kind to the boy, Mr. Heathcliff, or you'll not keep him long, and he's all you have akin in the wide world that you will ever know. Remember." "I'll be very kind to him, you needn't fear," he said, laughing. "Only nobody else must be kind to him. I'm jealous of monopolising his affection. And to begin my kindness, Joseph, bring the lad some breakfast. Hareton, you infernal calf, begone to your work. Yes, Nell," he added when they had departed, "my son is prospective owner of your place, and I should not wish him to die till I was certain of being his successor. Besides, he's mine, and I want the triumph of seeing my descendant fairly lord of their estates, my child hiring their children to till their father's land for wages. That is the sole consideration which can make me endure the whelp. I despise him for myself. I hate him for the memories he revives. But that consideration is sufficient. He's as safe with me and shall be tended as carefully as your master tends his own. I have a room upstairs furnished for him in handsome style. I've engaged a tutor, also, to come 3 times a week from 20 miles distance to teach him what he pleases to learn. I've ordered Hareton to obey him, and in fact I've arranged everything with a view to preserve the superior and the gentleman in him, above his associates. I do regret, however, that he so little deserves a trouble. If I wished any blessing in the world, it was to find him a worthy object of pride,
and I'm bitterly disappointed with the way-faced whining wretch. The boy is installed at the Heights, a pawn in his father's vengeful game, his health waning under a damp chill and neglect. Young Kathy does not know where her momentary cousin has disappeared to. 3 years more unfold, and Kathy, now 16, chafes at her confinement. Edgar's health falters, his grief for Catherine never fully healed, but he permits Nellie to accompany Kathy on short rides across the moors, provided they stay clear of Wuthering Heights. Alas, Wuthering Heights has no intention of staying clear of them. On the moor, the two ladies encounter Heathcliff and Hareton. The dark man cunningly mentions Linton to Kathy, who is immediately overcome with a desire to see her cousin, having been unaware that he had been living so close for so long. And so, against Nellie's insistence, they go to Wuthering Heights. There, Kathy rediscovers Linton, his cheeks flushed with fever, his complaints incessant. Heathcliff does not pass on the opportunity to sow distrust between Kathy and her father, tactically revealing her father's flaws and history to her. When darling Kathy confronts her father, Edgar, as delicately and as articulately as he can, implores his sweet daughter to know the true history of what they have all endured at the hands of cruel Heathcliff, and to let her know of the great danger he presents to all their precious joys. And though Kathy accepts the truth about Heathcliff, she cannot shake her pity for Linton. She conspires in secret, arranging correspondence through a milk boy to exchange letters with Linton. Linton's letters are dictated by Heathcliff, laced with pleas that draw Kathy back, her compassionate heart overriding caution. Nellie discovers this plot and burns the letters, leaving Edgar in ignorance of the whole affair. But Heathcliff is relentless. Surprising Kathy in person and manipulating her with guilt and deceit, he tells her that he will be away for a week and that he encourages her to go to visit Linton herself. Begrudgingly, Nellie agrees to this. True to his word, Heathcliff is not there, nor need he be. Linton's desperate state toys with Kathy's heart. Even as he whinges and chides her, she is compelled to care for him. The breath of winter delivers Nellie a cold, and Kathy cares for her attentively by day and visits Linton secretly by night. She continues to mock Hareton for his illiteracy, even as he tries to learn and show improvement. Visit by visit, Kathy is disenchanted by Linton, whose manifest flaws break forth more with every interaction. Kathy decides that she will visit him no more. Nellie is satisfied with this outcome, and the secret meetings are revealed to her father. To help remove his daughter's temptations, the ailing Edgar consents for Linton to visit them at Thrushcross Grange, where they'll be sure to have more responsible oversight. This plan proves unworkable, though, due to Linton's frailty. So it is agreed that the two may meet halfway on the moor. By this time, all chances for happiness seem to be slipping further and further from Kathy's power. Both Linton and her father are dying. Torn between two affections, Kathy reluctantly leaves her father to visit Linton on the moors. Linton was much too weak to make such a journey, and so Kathy and Nellie are drawn closer to Wuthering Heights, and Linton pleads pathetically. With streaming face and an expression of agony, Linton had thrown his nervous frame along the ground. He seemed convulsed with exquisite terror.
Oh, I cannot bear it. Catherine, I'm a traitor too, and I dare not tell you, but leave me and I shall be killed.
Dear Catherine, my life is in your hands, and you have said you love me, and if you did, it wouldn't harm you. You'll not go then, kind, sweet, good Catherine, and perhaps you will consent, and he'll let me die with you.
My young lady, on witnessing his intense anguish, stooped to raise him. The old feeling of indulgent tenderness overcame her vexation, and she grew thoroughly moved and alarmed.
Consent to what? She asked. To stay? Tell me the meaning of this strange talk, and I will. You contradict your own words and distract me. Be calm and frank, and confess at once all that weighs on your heart. You wouldn't injure me, Linton, would you? You wouldn't let an enemy hurt me if you could prevent it. I believe you are a coward for yourself, but not a cowardly betrayer of your best friend.
But my father threatened me,
gasps the boy, clasping his attenuated fingers. And I dread him. I dread him. I dare not tell.
Oh, well, said Catherine with scornful compassion. Keep your secret. I'm no coward. Save yourself. I'm not afraid.
Her magnanimity provoked his tears. He wept wildly, kissing her supporting hands, and yet could not summon courage to speak out. I was cogitating what the mystery might be, and determined Catherine should never suffer to benefit him or anyone else by my goodwill. When, hearing the rustle among the ling, I looked up and saw Mr. Heathcliff almost close upon us, descending the heights.
If you enjoyed this piece of premium content from the Lotus Eaters, head to our website where you can find more.
Tyler Reddick here from 2311 Racing. Another checkered flag for the books. Time to celebrate with Chumba. Jump in at ChumbaCasino.com. Let's Chumba.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See TNCs 21+. Sponsored by Chumba Casino.